podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Who would have thought it? Who would have thought we'd have got to this many episodes when I began all those weeks ago, 10 weeks ago? And you know, making it into double figures is something I'm immensely proud of. And I really feel like I've achieved something kind of like, you know, maybe not climbing Everest, maybe a smaller mountain than Everest, but I feel like it's been a huge accomplishment up there with my 2,000 meter swimming badge and my gold arrow that I got at Cubs. And I think I got a Creative Circle bronze that equates to this as well at one point in my career. Anyway, wonderfully to go with the enormity of this occasion, I have managed to secure an interview with the great and wonderful Vinnie Warren. If you've had a look at the blog, you'll obviously know that he's the guy who came up with WhatsApp, which everyone said a lot around the year 2000, 2001, from cool people to dickheads. It was the catchphrase of the year and the catchphrase of the decade and beyond. I think I put this on the blog or mentioned it somewhere, that I was watching American Dad the other day, and sure enough, there was a WhatsApp. So that was great. But there's lots of other elements to Vinnie's career that are worth finding out about. And as someone who moved from Ireland to New York, then Boston, then Chicago, and made a really great and interesting career and started his own agency, there's a huge amount in here that hopefully everyone will find very useful. And he's also a very engaging, chatty fella. So without further ado, here's our conversation. So, hi, Vinnie.
Hello.
Thanks for making the time to talk to me. That's very kind of you. I've tended to start these conversations off, as I'm sure if I've got any regular listeners will know, by asking how and why the person I'm talking to got into advertising in the first place. So if you could give us a bit of information on that side of things, that'd be a good way to intro, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll tell you, the backstory is, I think I may have read this on your blog, actually. It was a comment in one of your blogs. And they said that Danny Baker's mom died when he was 12 or something. You know, the radio guy?
Yeah.
And someone in your blog commented that it was that he said in his book or whatever that it was like a starting gun went off in his head, and he went boom, I gotta go, you know. And I had a similar experience in that when I was just about to graduate from college, my mom died suddenly and violently, and I realized that for all I knew, I was in middle age already, you know, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
And that had a huge impact on my. On my psyche and my outlook and everything. And suddenly I didn't have to settle for the job that I thought my mom wanted because my mom was dead, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, I thought, hey man, what do you want to really do with your life? You know, I didn't know. I'd been through college, but that was more a way of, you know, staving off reality for a few years than anything else. And I came out of college with a business degree, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I did know that I didn't want to settle. You know?
Yeah.
So I did not want to settle. And I was going to hang out. I was going to, you know, take the few years after college, not rush into accountancy simply to make my mom happy, you know? So that was a kind of a liberating thing in a way, you know? And so what I ended up doing as a result of that was kind of drifting for a bit between London and New York and then back to London again. And I said, well, I need a job, and I don't want to be I lived in a squat briefly in Willesden Green. I didn't want to do that for eternity. Fun though it was.
The Irish part of town.
What?
The sort of Irish part of town, because you're near Kilburn.
Yeah, Willesden Green, yeah. I remember there was three squats. One was at Galway, my hometown. One was Aussie, and one was Kiwi. And it was a fun time, as you can imagine, in your early 20s. And I was looking around. I was still waiting for the inspiration. And so I figured I'd take a job in what interests me most, which is watching telly, you know?
Yeah.
That was my, watching snooker, watching telly. That was me, 80s kid.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I got a job with ITV selling airtime, right, to the advertising agencies, the media agencies in London. And I wasn't particularly good at that. But one thing I was really good at, because I watched telly all the time, I could predict the ratings. Like a motherfucker. Mm. Centre break of Countdown, Channel 4, 2.5. You know, I knew I had a feel for the medium, you know. And part of the of working with ITV was I got to meet the agency guys in London, you know.
Yeah.
I was like, that's what I want to be doing. I don't want to be doing this. I want to be doing that. And so I was trying, well, how do I do that? And they had a thing called the GNAD workshops, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I'll try that. I'll give that a shot. And through that, with the help of a creative from Newcastle, who did the, from Newcastle Poly, a real nuclear guy. I was going to say Newcastle guy. a real Newcastrian.
Novacastrian.
Like, Vinny, you got to do some ads, you know? and so he put me on the track to get into the workshops. And I was like, I love this. Every time we went there was beer and there was fun and there was creativity and there was, you know, some junior team pretending they were the senior guys at the agency, you know?
Yeah.
And I loved it. And I remember, of course, when you start out, you're crap, you know, you got nothing, you know, like your muscles like just underdeveloped, you know,
yeah.
And you're struggling to imitate something you've seen in the DNAD annual or something, or on the Chew platform. And I remember I got the first encouragement I ever got in my life was from Rooney Carruthers and Larry Barker, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, Vinny, you did a great job. And we all got drunk at the Barley Mow pub. Which is near DDB London, and I'm like, I'm in, I got it, you know, I'm a star, clearly. Well, I wasn't. I had a long way to go. I didn't know that. And then I did another DNAD course, and I met two guys called Will Audrey and Martin Galton, who were at BBA, and they were kind of a hot team at the time. And I just gotten it's a long story. I'm sorry. Am I going?
No, no, it's all good. Okay. All good.
So, but it all makes sense at the end. And I'm hanging out with them in this pub after the course. And I just got a green card, weirdly, in a lottery. In a green card lottery that was kind of bent towards giving it to Irish people. And we all got one. And I had the opportunity to go to America. And I'm like, I think I want to go to America. I think I've had enough of London. And so I asked these guys, who should I work for in London? And they were like, What I actually said to them, you'll like this. What I actually said to them was, who's the American Dave Trott? Who is he? Who's the guy? That's all I wanted. I only wanted to work for Dave Trott. And I'd been on a DNAD course where we went to Gold Greenlee's Trott, and he just left, and I was crushed. I was two Northern Irish guys did the course, and I'm like, I was really shoot them, because they weren't Dave Trott.
Yeah.
And they said, Dave Trott. So I literally got on a plane with two words in my mind. This guy, they said, who I should work for, Ed McCabe. He's the man. Ed McCabe, he's the American Dave Trott. So I went to New York with those two words inscribed in my brain. I'm not going to work for anyone else. I'm going to work for Ed McCabe, not knowing anything, really, about anything. And then I get to New York, and I find out that he's out of advertising. He's not there anymore, right? He's taking a break, and he's sold his agency, and he's no longer at Scally McCabe Sloves, the agency that made him famous. So I'm in a bit of a pickle. There's no Abe McCabe. So I need to get my book together. So what I do is I take a class at the School of Visual Arts in New York at night. I'm driving a horse and carriage by night as well, in Central Park. That was my first job in New York. And 2 years later, I get hired by him when he starts a new agency. And I'm waiting, and I'm the first guy in the door. He didn't hire me. Second guy in the door didn't hire me. Finally, he hired me. And that's how I get into advertising. So I blame Martin Galton and Will Audrey for that. Took forever. It felt like forever. It was 2 years.
Yeah, that is a good story. When you were, were you having those conversations with people like Rooney and Larry? Is this the early 90s we're talking about?
Yeah, this was actually 1989. Yeah, they were kind of juniors. It's funny, because they were kind of comparatively junior, and they were still really amped about being in advertising. You know what I mean? They were like, yeah, guys, it's amazing, and Ronnie Barker's son. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and what made you apply for the green card in the first place? Was that part of the starting
gun thing? I'd actually done that a few years prior.
Yeah.
Like when I was in college, there was this law passed. It was one of those, like, you know, laws that was engineered by Irish America to help Ireland out. And so we all applied and forgot about it. And then your number came. It was like the draft in reverse. Oh. You know, it was like getting your draft number called in the 1970s, except it was a good thing, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, Ed McCabe is a legend, and it is the American Dave Trott, I guess, in a lot of ways, if there is one. So what was it like working under such a, you know, a huge figure in from the world of advertising?
It was kind of intimidating, to be honest with you. I mean, he was a legend, but he was a legend from the 70s and the 80s, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
And his thing was adrenaline, right? That was the secret to everything. If you weren't adrenalized, you weren't going to have good ideas, right? Makes sense.
Yeah.
And he was one of those guys who was naturally gifted at the job. Like, he just had an innate talent for strategy and creative execution, you know? Not everybody does.
Yeah.
And he did. And he'd done it. He had many chances to prove how good he was, and he rarely failed. And the thing about working for him was that he was, you had to get in line with his style. Like, you had to be explosive and hard hitting and strategically on the money and provocative and all those things. And that was hard to do, you know? And he wasn't a kind teacher. He was legendary for being brutal. And he was brutal. Like, I'll give you a good example. I always struggled for an analogy for this question, because I tell people I work for Ed McCabe and they go, what's that like? And now I have one. Do you ever see the movie Devil Wears Prada?
Of course, yeah.
That was it.
So he was Meryl Streep or Anna Wintour.
That was it.
Right.
Like, if somebody said to you, if his secretary came to you and said, Ed wants to talk to you, you'd like melt.
Right.
You'd be like, what do you mean Ed wants to talk to me? About what? He'll just come up to me and, you know, what's his mood? What? Like, it was just like that movie. But the good thing about it was that you put yourself under enormous pressure, you know?
Yeah, and do you think that enormous pressure did, you know, as he intended, did it create really good work?
It did. I'd imagine it was not unlike the Charles Saatchi 1980s era of Charlie's Mad and Please Charlie, you know?
Yeah.
I guess it was, I'm imagining it was something like that.
Cool. And can I just ask you, because I don't want to just let it slide. When I interviewed Jeff LeBay and he said he'd ridden the rodeo, I was like, what the fuck? I couldn't just let it go. So I was in New York a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, I was in earlier in the year as well. And when we got near Central Park and we saw those guys, I said to my wife, you know, Vinny used to ride one of those or drive one of those horse-drawn carriages thing. Now, I know there's a funny story about you nearly losing it when you were in a bar or something. What's it like being that guy? And can you tell us the funny story again?
Well, basically what it was firstly, I fancied that job because I'd worked at ITV.
Yeah.
And I figured it would be a good resume burner. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I wanted to not do that anymore.
Right.
I didn't want to, like, you know, satisfy for myself, pretend I was in advertising by having a job in media and hoping it would happen when I was 35 or something. So I knew the time clock was ticking. So I'm like, all right, if I'm a horse and carriage driver, it's kind of hard to come back from, you know what I mean? And then you'd have to get into design. Or, you know, I wanted it to be a problem. So I love the idea of having a job where I could think. That didn't work out, and basically be free to who I wanted to pursue, who I wanted to be, while taking these classes at the School of Visual Arts, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, I'd never worked with horses in my life, ever. No affinity with horses, who are actually, as Jeff would have told you, stupid animals. They're not smart, and so I had this crazy, surreal experience of Manhattan on a horse and carriage, you know. You know, negotiating traffic, the cops, everything, you know, rush hour traffic, doing all these, you know. And again, it was an adventure, but I thought it would be easy, and it wasn't easy, but it was funny. It was funny because if you spend 9 months on Central Park South, when I was there in 1990 or so, you will see everything from murder to, you name it, you know, pimps, I mean, you know, assassins. Somebody once, I remember one of the lesser stories of my time there was, and this was like, this tells you how crazy New York is at the time. I remember driving a Canadian couple around Central Park, and this guy comes out, he's wearing camouflage, comes out of the greenery about 60 yards, 50, you know, whatever far it was, 30 yards away from me. And I see him. It's 2 in the morning. And I see him. And he's got a crossbow and he's pointing it at me. And I'm like, he's probably not going to hit me from there. Fuck that. He probably missed. You know? But I did lose my horse in Manhattan. And it was the first night I was working there on my own. And I turned around to get a light from a cigarette. And I smoked back then. And I turn around and my horse is gone. My horse is gone. And my horse is going home. And home means going down 7th Avenue through Times Square at 7 in the evening on a summer's evening.
Oh, my God.
And he's going to kill a bunch of German tourists. That's the way it ends. That's just the way it always ends, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm fucked. And I ran after him, and I almost got the horse. I really got this close to getting the horse back, jumping in the carriage, grabbing the lines. I had a plan. And he saw me coming after him, and he sped up. And I remember the last thing I saw on my horse was he was turning down 7th Avenue, and I saw the two wheels go up in the air, you know, because he's going so fast. He wasn't stopping for the light. Horses don't stop for traffic lights.
Weirdly.
Kids.
Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to run to Iceland. I'm going to go to Norway. I'll go back to Ireland. It'll be fine. Because in carnage, that I knew there was going to be carnage, right?
Yeah.
As he's headed towards Times Square. And he's not going to stop for the lights. So best case scenario, he gets killed. And it's a huge PR story in the press. And I remember making the decision going, oh, fuck it. I'm just going to go see what happened. I ran up to 7th Avenue because 57th Street is a two-way street.
Yeah.
And I'm in 59th Street. So he's not going to make it past 57th Street, right? There's no way that can happen, right? And I turn down the corner and I see my horse and there's a cop holding the horse on 56th Street. And I'm like, oh, he lived. We're all right. It's going to be fine. And I ran down to the cop and I said, how the hell did you do that? And he goes, yeah, it turned out, long story short, they were in a van, not a car, which is key to the story, because if they were in a car, they couldn't have been higher up. The horse is higher up, right?
Yeah.
And so they saw this horse go by. They were trying to get, like, they were junior cops, just out of the police academy cops. And they saw him go by, and they were from the Bronx. And he goes, hey, I don't think there's anyone driving that horse, man. That's going to be a problem. So what they did was I didn't even see this because I was in such a blind bit of standing. They actually tried to grab his bridle, which is a good instinct, but a bad instinct because of scary horses. The horses are not going to like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this didn't work. So what they did was they had a van, not a car. They went down 7th Avenue and cut off the lights for the horse so the horse could get through unimpeded. And then they slowly cut him off. And then one of them grabbed the horse, the bridle, which is the only thing to do, and held him. And I couldn't believe it. And like these guys are like an Italian guy and a Puerto Rican guy from the Bronx, and they saved my life, and they saved, you know, countless German tourists their lives as well. And I couldn't believe that. That was the first night.
That's great. Okay, so go back into what was Ed's agency called then? Was it another?
It was McCabe and Company.
Okay.
Yeah, McCabe and Company. And it was his kind of comeback to advertising. He took a year off to do the Paris-Dakar rally.
Wow.
Yeah, and he wrote a book about that called Against Gravity, which is on Amazon,
okay.
Which I recommend if you're in advertising.
Yeah.
And then he came back and started another agency in New York. My claim to fame is the guy who preceded me lasted for 2 months. I lasted for 2 years. The guy after me also lasted for 2 months, which I think gives you some kind of...
Yeah. Honestly,
yeah, it was like that. It's Vietnam. Vietnam.
So you did 2 years there, and then... So I guess that was a great education, baptism of fire, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was total baptism of fire and total, you know, exposure to one of the giants of the industry. And, you know, you learn by osmosis. Not, you know, he wasn't coming around to me going, hey, Vinny, you know, let me tell you a few things. No, it was brutal war, you know.
Yeah, so I guess after 2 years, was it your choice to move on or his choice? And where did you go?
It was both of our choices. It was one of those things where the problem I was having working for him was that while I was learning from this kind of older guy from the previous era, Wyden and Kennedy and Goodby and all these things were starting to pop up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was learning from a master, but I wasn't doing like Little Caesar's spots with Cliff Freeman,
yeah.
You know? And I knew people who worked in those environments. And I was kind of getting sick of it, you know, and of not of dealing with him, though I was thinking of dealing with him. I wanted to do TV because I knew TV was my medium. And there wasn't that much opportunity to do that there, right? And so what happened was a recruiter came to town from DDB Chicago. They just got into Budweiser account. And I grew up with, you know, the Dave Trott and the, you know, I bet he drinks Carling Back label and all that stuff. And that's what I kind of wanted to do. And as a kid growing up in Ireland, in Galway, I spent 5 years working in a really busy pub in Galway, you know. It's kind of also a formative experience, you know. And so I was like, I want to do beer commercials, you know.
Yeah, so and did the idea of moving to Chicago not bother you, excite you? Was that was
not
that
at all, not at all. Once I made the decision based on, you know, one of the things I kind of realized when I, you know, my mom died, I went to London, and I'm in London, I go to New York. Once you do that enough, you get freed from the idea of being in a particular place. And so I was very career-oriented and determined to do something famous, right? So I'm like, I'll go to Chicago. I didn't have any kids. I'll go to Chicago. No, we had no problem. You know?
Cool. And did you have a partner at this time? And did you move with the partner, or was it all just...
No, I didn't. What I did was I was my own thing. So I was I just got the hell out of New York. And honestly, I'm not kidding you. One of the thoughts I had is that if New York was, I'll never have to hear about Donald Trump again. It's 1995. I had that thought. I was counting up the reasons as I drove out of Chicago, of New York, going, you know, I'm going to miss this, the pizza. But you know, the good thing is I'll never have to hear about Donald Trump ever again. Well, I was wrong. But I was just I had married then, by the way. I was married, I married youngishly by comparison. I was married by age 25.
Right.
And I was on my road. I was just like, what do I have to do? I'll do it. Whatever I have to do, I'll do it. So moving to Chicago, I was like, yeah, I'll do that. No problem, you know.
Yeah, ironically, when I was in Chicago in the summer, basically the first building I saw had the word Trump on it in massive letters. It's that one by the river. I don't know how many Trump buildings there are in Chicago, but one was enough for me. So DDB Chicago. So were you on Budweiser straight away?
Yeah, I was hired for Budweiser, and I worked on it. And they had this campaign which featured frogs and lizards and all this stuff, right? And I had a religious adversity to doing beer commercials with animals in them. No. I'm like, I know how it works. I've worked in a bar. I know how it works, right? It doesn't work that way. You're appealing to 10-year-olds. And I just hated it, right? So I was like, well, what else have you got? And they had another beer account called Bud Light, right?
Yeah.
And they had a hit campaign called I Love You, Man, which when I joined the account, they had this thing was a phenomenon, right? You may have heard of it. Or seen it. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant commercial. It's one of the best beer commercials ever done.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I do know that one. Yeah, yeah. That's great.
And unluckily for me, this was the hit campaign. And guess what? They didn't need another one, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, this has to die for me to make a mark, you know, somehow, right?
Yeah.
And they beat it to death. You know, they didn't do good sequels. And then it started to fade off really quickly. And so I was ready with my, at this point, I was like, one of the things I'd done when I lived in New York was I was like, oh, I made the decision, I'm like, I'm not going to be an immigrant. I'm not going to live in an Irish enclave, although I did. But I'm not going to be, you know, looking for the tea from the hometown and the sausages and all that stuff. I'm like, I'm an American now. So what I did was I watched Nick at Night, which was this TV channel on cable that showed all the old shows, so I could become an expert on American comedy and American TV shows from the last 30 years, right? And my conclusion was, they love slapstick. Boy, do they love slapstick. So my very first commercial, which I think I've shown you, was $800,000 worth of slapstick, right? Yeah. And that was the thing that knocked I Love You, Man out of the public consciousness, because it was just so stupid and aggressive, you know, and funny, you know, if you like people walking and running into poles. and that's kind of what I did. I was, you know, I needed a hit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess, I don't know how far it was from there to What's Up, but how did What's Up land on your plate as a brief?
Well, basically what happened with What's Up was, in the intervening times, I moved to Boston. You know Pete Favette? Head of Deutsch?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
he hired me away from DDB because he was so impressed that I could make a commercial out of one word. And he was a cool guy. And I worked in Boston for 2 years, right? And I worked on Reebok, among other things. And in the meantime, I had a break from the beer land, you know what I mean? Like 2 year break, right?
Yeah.
And so I come back to DDB, and whenever you work on beer for a while, it kind of gets into your blood, you know, it gets into your being, and you kind of look at things forever as like, you know, that'd be a good beer commercial, that'd be a good beer commercial. So I had 2 years of that'd be a good beer commercial, Bud commercial, because I love the brand, I love Budweiser, I like the drink and I like the brand, you know. And so I came back to DDB Chicago armed with all these ideas about what we should really do. I had an attitude about it, you know. My whole thing was about beer was after I had that initial burst of, you know, getting the commercials out of your system that everybody does when they're hiding from their voice and they're doing things like parodies of things and you know what I mean? Yeah. Like all that stuff. I was like, I was over that. So I'm coming back and I'm like, it's Vinny time. I'm going to give you, you're going to hear me now, you know? So my attitude was, stop acting like you've invented beer last week and it's a fucking elixir of life. It's $5 at any 7-Eleven. Get over that. Go with what you've got, you know, go with your place in the culture, you know? That was my whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. You have a place in the culture that's unique. It's like Guinness in Ireland. And take advantage of that. Stop acting like it hasn't happened, you know, in your advertising. So I came back with all these ideas, like for Super Bowl, because it was a Super Bowl-based advertiser. And I'm like, and I'd seen this. I'm sorry, I'm going on. I talk at length, sorry. We should break it up. And Vinny, what happened next? we'll cut that
I'll
in
put later. That in later.
We'll cut that in later, yeah. You do this fake reporter shot. The nod to camera. So this was on my radar, you know. All this thing was on my radar, my antenna, rather, or whatever it is. And so while I was at this agency in Chicago that I worked at briefly called Hal Riney, a producer had shown me a film that was the basis of the Was Up commercials. Because I worked on Reebok, I had an appreciation for the disproportionate impact of African-American culture on the American culture, right?
Yeah.
I had that in my head. And I saw this tape of a video. It was a 2-minute, 30-second short film that had been a bit of a hit on the short film circuit. She showed me a third-generation VHS tape of this film. And I looked at it once, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is the Bud commercial of all time. You know why? Because they're watching sports, and they've got a catchphrase that's as good as I love you, man. In fact, it's American for hello. And it kind of blew my mind. Like, it was so perfect, I couldn't believe how perfect it was, you know? And then months later, I got hired back at DDB. I play this tape for my boss, and I go, dude, this is a catchphrase, man. We're going to kill it, just like I love you, man. Remember that those days? And that was it. It was like, and my boss was like, I love it. The client loved it. Produce it. You know, it was very smooth in that regard. It was like a dream happening.
And you hired the director of the short film to do that?
Yes. Charles Stone III. The funny thing was, this is like 1999, right? So you were still, not everything was online, you know?
Yeah.
And so we actually sold the idea of What's Up as beer commercial catchphrase to Budweiser. And they were like, yeah, well, let's do it. It's only $500,000, you know? And they were like, let's do it. And then our problem was, we have to tell this guy we just sold his idea. So I had to sell him on, Charles. I had to get on the, track him down, call him up and go, Charles, we just sold your idea to Budweiser for the Super Bowl. Do you want to do it? You know, very strange conversation. And then I had to convince him that we weren't going to turn it into some kind of Pepsi, you know, not very cool thing, that we actually wanted the essence of his original idea.
And so was he pretty receptive to that then?
No, not at all. But I convinced him, because I was like, dude, we have complete creative freedom, which we did. I mean, the situation in Budweiser was that, you know, you would present your idea and then you would go and shoot it and no clients would show up or anything. There was no, it was a very loose situation. And so I told him that. I said, we've got complete creative control, do it, and I'll back you every step of the way, you know?
And so once you had it done, I guess, what was there a point where you, I mean, obviously you said when you were writing it, you thought it was going to be the beer commercial or beer commercials, but yeah. I guess when you got it back and like back into the agency and you're showing your boss and the client, whatever, are you thinking this is going to be fucking huge, or yes. Are you thinking, I hope it's going to be huge?
It was weird because the weird thing was, because of my education on I Love You Man, I knew it was going to be huge. Like once I saw it, I'm like, oh, this is the answer to everything, right? And so all we needed to do was to get it. Like, the original film was shot on bad video in somebody's apartment in New York, you know?
Yeah.
We had money and we had editorial skills and all that stuff. So this was going to be way better. And the reason I was confident was because I'm the kind of guy who, like, if I like something, I'll share it with everybody and see their reaction to it. And then if they react well, I'm like, all right, we're in, we're good. So I would show this to everybody. And I remember I would see, like, and it was all white people I was showing it to, right? White agency people, right? And I would show them the VHS. And then a week later, I'd meet them and they go, what's up? And I go, what's up? And then I knew that was the first viral. And I'm like, we have it. We got it. I had that to back me up, you know? And so when we shot it, we committed totally to the gag. There was no second, you know, if you look at it, it was very confidently done because we knew we had it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the weird thing. And when it became a huge hit, it was weird because people would come up to me and tell me, you couldn't have known that was going to be big. I'm like, yeah, yes, I did. And you know what I mean? It was one of those annoying things of like, well, yes, it's my job, it's my life, you know, to have a hit campaign. I didn't care where it came from, you know?
Cool. So what were the, I guess, what were the things that happened after, like, how soon did it take off and how soon was it being said all over the fucking planet? And what was, like, the most interesting kind of manifestation of its giant size?
I'll tell you what this is how viral it was, right? While we were doing post-production, every step is post-production, juniors at the production houses, post-production houses would appear and go, can we see the commercials? Can we see what you're doing? And they would laugh their asses off and leave. And then someone else would come back. It was like having a celebrity in the room. That's what it was like.
Wow.
It was weird. It was strange. I've never experienced that again. You know, now I have to pay people to come in and pretend they want to see my post-production. But it was, that was the strange thing. It was like from day one, it was viral. Like boom, boom, boom. Every step of the way, it was like bang, bang, bang. No, there was like, it was irresistible, basically. That was the whole point of it. It was irresistible. And I remember, so when we're post-production, it's crazy good. We get the cut, and you got to remember, this is intended for the Super Bowl, and we shot it in December, right?
Yes.
Super Bowl is in February. We, when the clients saw it, they're like, put it on the air.
Well, before the Super Bowl?
Yeah. Put it on the air on this Christmas Day NBA game. You know, they were smart enough to realize, this is, we don't have to wait for the Super Bowl, right? And within 2 weeks, it was boom. It was crazy. I remember when I went to I used to do this when I worked in Budweiser and Bud Light. It's a good technique. Do it. I would always. I don't like sports. I'm not a big sports fan. I don't hate sports. I like snooker. It's the difference, yeah, right? That's a big difference. And Irish rugby, because we beat New Zealand. But so I would go to these sports bars. I hate sports bars, right? And I would go sit in front of the screen looking at the audience whenever I had a spot running on sports, and it was always on sports, to get their reaction, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember going to the bar, a bar, it didn't really matter, to see the reaction of the American beer-drinking audience to, in a sports environment, to the What's Up commercials. And it was a damp, you know, December day, and I think it was the 23rd of December. And I looked at the reaction, and it was nothing. There wasn't even cracking a smile, right? And I'm like, oh, fuck, where did I mess this one up? And then I waited a bit, and it came on again, you know, because they had a big media budget.
Yeah.
The second time round, it was like people were nudging each other when they're, you know, that's pretty funny, right? And they could see the agreement, like, yeah, that's pretty funny, you know? And it just went crazy from there. And the funny thing is like, my wildest dreams was of like a Carling Black Label, you know, kind of, you know, that kind of thing, yeah. You know, that cultural effect. And it just went so far beyond that. That was the unsettling thing, you know?
Yeah, and I guess, were all Budweiser ads run all over the world at that point? Because we got it and we were all WhatsApping it at Abbey Mead Vickers.
You know, what happened was, it ran here, before, you know, in the month of December, which is big NFL time, NFL sports. And so it ran the NFL. It took off like crazy. It did exactly what we'd hoped it to do. The catchphrase got on exactly as we hoped it would. But the weird part was it went way beyond what we'd expected it to be. You know what I mean? That was the weird thing for me, was that part of it.
So they chose to run it all over the world?
No. What happened was it ran all over the world via email.
Oh, right. It wasn't a media buy around the world.
Oh, no. It was an email.
Wow.
It was a viral hit through email. Remember when things were sent through email?
Yeah. Okay.
And aggregator sites and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That's where it went crazy online. And that was the crazy thing, because for me, there was like a couple of moments that were like, all right, now you got a hit. Now you got a global hit, you know. And the thing, the funny part of it was that, you know, you like to think you're controlling things, you know, at some level. You know, like, you know, at some level, you like to think you have control. And when it went out of our control, we were like, God damn it, that's not supposed to happen. You know, even though they're good things, you know, like, for example, I went back to Ireland in February or March after we did it, right, to visit my family. And I remember being in a pub in New York, in Galway, and pubs closed, all the young Irish beer drinking, you know, idiots come out onto the square, and they're all kicked out of the pub. And I remember hearing this, what's up? And I'm like, I was actually scared. I remember being, like, having an apprehensive moment of anxiety, because I didn't plan this, you can't do this, you know? And it was like that, you know? Yeah. And it was email.
Wow, I didn't, that must be one of the first viral ads, I guess, then.
It was, people say it was viral, but we had a great seeding program because we had Anheuser-Busch's massive media budget.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it went viral, but it wasn't intended to be, you know what I mean? It was intended to be a TV hit, but the added bonus was it went globally viral, I think, because we were talking to the generation that had swallowed hip-hop whole, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That was the big lesson, was that it was like, we weren't coming along in 1988 trying to sell you on African American culture. We unintentionally timed that bit right, you know. I think.
Absolutely, and I occasionally hear What's Up still happening now. And when I do hear about it, I'll send you like a message to go. Yeah. Have you seen like 21 Jump Street? They're saying What's Up in 21 Jump Street, and it's still yes. going on now. So, what's been, say, the most satisfying? Famous What's Up there's been, like, being taken off into culture. Has there been like a TV show or a famous person who said it that you remember?
Well, I have a bunch of those. We could be here all night about that. Because the weird thing about What's Up was that not only was it a cultural hit, it was adopted by the culture and it was parodied endlessly, like endlessly, to the point where I was sick of them. I was, you don't think you can have eat enough cake. You know, I ate enough too much cake.
Wow.
Like, too much coming at me. I was like, stop it. Just stop it. I'm done. I would be a really bad celebrity, I think. I'd be a reclusive celebrity if that was the case. I'll give you a great one. This is my favorite one, right? So two months after it became a hit, and we're getting, like, you know, Newsweek and USA Today and New York Times and boo, right? All that stuff. It's funny how quickly you become accustomed to that. Like, I was amazed at how blasé I became about, oh, really, stop it, you know. Scary Movie 2 wants to send us a tape. Scary Movie, we'll send them a tape. Whatever, right? And I remember being in New York, and we were shooting the second round of the sub campaign, right? And this time we had a huge hit in our hands. And it was Saturday night. We shot for 7 days. I was baked and tired and fried and everything you can imagine. And it was 7, 9 in the evening or 10 in the evening in New York. And we're standing in the lobby of our hotel, and all our phones go off. And it's my wife calling me, and somebody else is calling them with the great news that the season opener of Saturday Night Live started with a sketch parodying What's Up, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's brilliant, right? And literally, this was our reaction. Click, where do you want to go for dinner? Like, it was that, we became, we didn't even give it a second thought, right? And then, years later, a couple of years later, not that long ago, I remember The English Office came out. And there was a big lot of hype from my family in Ireland. Oh, you got to watch The Office. You got to watch The English Office. And I'm watching it with my daughter. and Ricky Gervais, David Brent's character, to establish how out of touch he is with, you know, offbeat he is, he goes in and goes, "What's up? What's up? What's up?" My daughter was like 7, and she's like, "Daddy did that." And it's still the best thing of all time, you know?
That's great. Yeah, now you're, I mean, that's going to be a classic series like 40 Towers, so you're
forever and I'm in there.
Embedded. So
I'm like the American in the American episode of Folly Dark. My mind, anyway.
Yeah, and so you mentioned shooting the follow up or follow ups. How was the difficult second album process?
The interesting thing about that campaign was it was because it was a global viral and it was all this getting all this attention. I was the first one to be sick of it too.
Right.
So I was also the first guy who was like, "I can't take this anymore. I got to do something else." So we actually did. There was a conscious effort on my part. I never made this explicit to the client or the agency. But I was like, "How do we kill it?" Right. Like that was my instinct. Wasn't let's not prolong it because other people are prolonging it, you know, by parodies online. My instinct was let's kill it. Let's do something that'll kill it, right? And the strange part about that was everything I did to kill it only made it more popular. It was like. Like, we tried doing things that were like, "Hey, guys, we get it. It's a joke. Stop doing this." and it just made it bigger. And I just gave up. I'm like, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm done, you know. But we did it. Like, for example, my art director partner on the campaign was this Jew, not Jewish guy, Irish-Italian guy from New Jersey. And he was a sushi monster, right? He was like a linebacker who could eat a ton of sushi. And we were always ended up in sushi, you know, Sushi Roku?
Yeah.
That was just our place, right? Yeah. While we were making the commercials. And one night in Sushi Roku, we were drinking sake and we're toasting the sushi chefs. And we're editing the commercials. He goes, "Wasabi, wasabi, wasabi, wasabi." And I'm like, and he was like, "That's a commercial, dude." And I'm like, "Oh, that is a commercial." And in my back of my mind, I'm going, "This is surely going to kill it." And it only added to it. It was probably the best executed thing we did, you know. And it was weird in that regard. You know what I mean? It was one of those things that you just go kind of like, "I want this to stop." You know, you don't imagine that part of it. Me and Paul McCartney have that in common. Just sort of
you do, you do. So out of interest, I mean, I guess just a little bit on the like award side of it, because obviously it won the Grand Prix at Cannes, didn't it?
And it did, yeah.
And other things like that. How, I mean, was it already so big that made no difference, or was it still the icing on the cake that was really quite satisfying?
You know, it was one of those, the honest to God truth of it is, I was such an advertising Buddhist monk. I regarded the Cannes Grand Prix as something that Brazilians won for fake ads that never ran. And I was just, I never even thought about it. And then we went to Cannes, the whole week of Cannes. Preceded by 2 days in Amsterdam, really bad idea.
Yes. Sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, we did that. Yes. And then we went and won it. And it was, the funny thing was, it became apparent to me that the DDB network had huge hopes that we'd win it. And if we didn't win it, it would be a huge disappointment because we were such big favorites. We were favorites to win. And so when we won it, it was more relief than anything else. But I got more joy from the public reaction. You know what I mean? It was yeah. Crazy. You know what I mean? Cannes meant, yeah, we got the Cannes Grand Prix, great, lovely, go home. Yeah.
And,
have a party. Have a party.
How did it affect your thing in the agency? Were you then like locked into being the Budweiser guy, or were you promoted? What happened after that?
Well, it was interesting because it was, I loved working at DDB. I was working with a great bunch of people and a great bunch of clients. And you know how it is at big agencies, you know, like a certain amount of jealousy crept in. To understand, I would have been jealous of me too, you know, hated me. But it was, you know, it was great. I mean, it was the perfect thing at the time for me because what it did was it was like great reinforcer of my instincts, you know. So after that, I'm like, after that campaign, I started, the briefs came, you know, everything was cool. Like it was, you know, I was a star of the agency because I did this campaign thing, you know, and I got promoted, I got money, I got to hang out with Keith Reinhardt a whole bit, and, you know, and it was just fun, you know, it was a dream-like experience that actually lasted about 2 years, you know?
Yeah, so if it lasted 2 years, how did it sort of come to a conclusion, or did you want to move on?
Yeah, I did. What I did was, and again, I look at everything culturally. As you do, because you're here and you're not an American. You look at things. You look at America and you go, what's up with these people, right? You know,
yeah.
You just think it's part of your everyday experience, right?
Yeah.
And so I'd seen the I Love You Men campaign end badly, and I was just determined that it wouldn't end badly. You know, so I knew there was an appetite. You know, for it, and then David Brent comes along and says it, and everybody hates it, right?
Yeah.
That's the cycle, and I knew it, right? Your dad says it, and it's no longer cool. Start out being cool, no longer cool. So my whole thing was, and we were also in competition with Goodby Silverstein on the account. They were working on it with us, right?
Yeah.
Right. So they stuck their oar in and did a white guy parody that was big on Super Bowl 2001. Right. And we thought about that idea. You know, we thought about everything. You know, we thought about grandmas and, you know, who's that? Goldfish, you know, whatever, doing what's up, right? Pigeons. And they did it, and it was a huge hit. And for a moment there, I was kind of like struck by like, wait a minute, it's my campaign, Jeff Goodby. You know, don't do this to me, right?
Yeah.
Then I had the brilliant, me and my Italian-American partner from New Jersey, the brilliant idea of doing Sopranos. Right?
Yeah.
We're going to do The Sopranos for as a follow-up. And their catchphrase in New Jersey was, hey, don't, right? And I love that. I lived in New York. I knew that area, right? And Sopranos was huge. So we got a director of The Sopranos to do a follow-up campaign, stole it away back from Goodby. And we did that for another year. And we got, like, Emmy nominations. And we actually got one of the directors of The Sopranos to shoot them. So we had The Sopranos crew and director doing our commercials, and we're parodying Sopranos.
Nice.
So that was kind of fun, you know?
Yeah, so I guess, did you, how long did you then stay at DDB, and where was your next move?
Well, I stayed at DDB, I joined them in 99, and I left in 2006, in the end of 2006, and in the meantime, I'd done, because I was kind of bored, you know, and just, it was one of those weird things where it's like, you know, again, this is the too much cake analogy. It's like, I couldn't go to any more award shows. I'd had enough. I'm deeper than I thought, unfortunately, for an ad guy.
Good problem to have.
I bumped into that problem, you know?
Yeah.
And so I realized I had to start my own agency. I just had to do it. I was like, otherwise I'm like, I was hanging out in college. You know, the mature students were hanging out in college. I started to feel like that, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, did the idea of like the sort of hassle of that sort of intimidate you or put you off? Or were you like,
no,
this is the next stage?
No, I think I've said this. I've probably posted everything I've said here on your blog at some point if you look at it back. But one of the things that I've always motivated me is like the clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And you only get one life. And let's try it. And let's go, you know? So that was it. I wasn't bothered by that because I was more bothered by the prospect of not maxing out the time I have on Earth, you know, than anything else. Because my mom died way too young. And maybe I will too. And let's not assume anything, you know?
Yeah.
That was my whole thing.
Yeah, so the...
It continues to be my thing.
That's good. Keep the fuel inside there.
The fuel, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think the escape pod's got a slightly different sort of way of doing things, as in, unless I'm mistaken about this, a sort of project-by-project basis situation with clients. Was that, like, always the idea and the intention?
No, the idea of the intention was to do... great work. Honestly, the idea was to do great work that reflects my values and my ambitions, right? So when you start an agency in America, you know, it doesn't matter that you've done What's Up. DDB Chicago did What's Up,
yeah.
Arguably, right? You know what I mean? That makes sense. So you've got to start over. And what that does is it gives you great energy because now you're looking at things from a different angle. You know, I was tired of the big agency, you know, that angle of things. And so I wanted to create something that would basically give me, selfishly, because I do look at things selfishly, and I think it's important that people do look at things selfishly. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but you've only got one life. And the idea was to do, well, you know, we are going to be hostage to the fact that we are a startup, and that's just the way startups work in America. You get projects, you know what I mean? Yeah. That's how it works, right? And then eventually you evolve into relationships with marketers, and that's how it goes, you know? Because people are taking a chance on you when you start out, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And was it more of an opportunity also for you to, I guess, nurture young talent as well? I've met some of the people who worked under you and whatever. Yeah. Did you feel like that was a great way to, you know, open another door into your skill set?
Absolutely, absolutely. You don't realize it when you're starting. I mean, Dave Trott realized it. I mean, he made a thing of it. But that becomes your job, you know? The ideas take care of themselves, you realize. It's the other things that are hard. You know, like getting and nurturing the talent and getting the chemistry. Because it's chemistry. We're in a chemistry business, you know? If you don't have chemistry, it's not going to work out, you know? That's how I look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you think, like, because some of the other spots you've done for Escape Pod have also been enormously successful in terms of, you know, being known around the country. I love the guy in the supermarket for the pickles, for instance. well, I'll put some of that on my blog as well. But so do you feel like there's been a similar kind of vein running through, possibly from Ed McCabe, of this, you know, cultural, you know, making a cultural statement or being out there for everyone beyond just the ad break?
My original inspiration kind of remains my main inspiration in the sense that, you know, like one of the things I like to think I am is fearless. I'm not afraid of anything. Like, I'm not afraid of anything executionally. I love everything. And I like to explore the full emotional spectrum, and I like to engage in things that I wouldn't necessarily be innate to me, you know, simply because I'm an immigrant, so I have to have that, you know, I have to have that about me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, where do you want to take it now, or is it in a position where it's the agency you wanted it to be, and you're kind of cool with that?
I have endless ambition because I have only one life, you know. That's the way I look at it. Like, so I'm never satisfied. You know what I mean? I'm the one of those guys who's never, ever, ever. I'm like Mark Maron of the podcast. I so empathize with him. It's like there's never enough. To me, you've got to pack it in because you're going to be dead. You know, and so. You know, like we've just done a bunch of things that are hugely exciting, you know, to shoot and to do and to this and everything. And every time I'm done, I'm like, what's next? What's next? Like, what's next? Well, how can we do this? What else can we do? Like there's never enough for me.
Cool. The other question I always wonder about when people start their own agencies is how you find like-minded people in different departments to do the same thing as you. Was that easy, or had you been collecting names throughout your career and gone, they'll be the guys?
Well, it's a bit of both. It's a bit of both. I mean, you need chemistry with your partners. You need similar philosophy-ish, you know. You need to have a broad agreement about what you're going to do. And then it becomes, and then you realize that things like when new agencies start up and they have these big philosophies and blah, 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 and no one cares, you know. It's really about how well do you work together. Sure. If you don't work together, it's not going to work. Simple as that. And on any creative execution, film, whatever it is. So you've got to just find the right people. Yeah, part of it was having my eye out from my partner. I'd look forever for somebody to start an agency with, and they just never appeared until I met my partner at DDB, and we're like, yeah, he's the guy. That's the guy, you know?
Absolutely. I was also wondering, like, because you've sort of reached that sort of a level of fame, definitely within industry, and the piece of work you did that you're most famous for was huge around the world. How is that regarded by your family back home in Ireland? Is that like, wow, look what Vinny did, or are they not as that bothered about it?
It was funny because you know how it is when you tell people you're a copywriter, they think you're in patent lawyer.
Yeah, they'll see by words.
That's usually the reference. So it was great for them to see my dad. My mom had died, obviously, but it was great for my dad and my sisters back in Galway to see that, you know, I wasn't a complete loser, basically. And it was fun. And, there's the funny one, though. It's the funny one, right? So, so we're getting... This is an aside. So I was getting all this PR in America and interviewed by all, you know, USA Today and New York Times and everything. And I went to the PR person, the head PR person, global PR person at DDB, and I went, hey, you know, it'd be great if I could get some PR in Ireland, right? And they were like, oh, fine, on it, got it, well, we're doing it, right? And what I didn't tell them was I wanted an article in the local paper. That's all I want. I've forgotten, neglecting the regional, tiny little local paper that I'm from, you know. And the next day, I'm in LA, and I get this call, and it's like, and she's like, "All right, you know who Jerry Ryan is?" And he's like, "He's this big Irish DJ, like radio show."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh no!" She goes, "And you know who Pat Kenny is? He's the other big, like Jenny Baker of Irish radio." He goes, "Yeah, we got a call tomorrow night." I had to contend with the prospect of you're going to make an ass of yourself on national radio, and our radio is a big medium in Ireland. You're going to fuck this up, dude. And it was the most embarrassing thing I ever did. It was terrible. I was so bad on the first interview. I was good in the second interview, but, you know. But that was huge because my sisters were listening. My schoolmates were listening, and there was Vinny from America, you know, talking shit. You know, it was funny. It's like being on Denny. Imagine if you were suddenly on Denny Baker or something like that, and then you think, "Oh, that's cool. I've talked to people on the phone before." No, you've talked to the entire nation. You know.
Yeah. My stance on that would be just fucking do it because it'd be a bit of a laugh anyway. And okay.
I thought that too. I thought that too until it was 2 a.m. And suddenly my breath is going, and I can't even exhale.
Cool. So I guess we're coming towards the sort of hour mark in this. I don't know if there was anything else you wanted to talk about. I often ask people this at the end of the thing in case there's something I haven't covered that they wanted to discuss. Is there anything along those lines for you?
You know, I mean, I've been lucky in my life, you know, and, you know, I always imagine, like when I listen to your podcast, like Paul Burke was so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kidding me? It might have peaked there. It's going to be a bad sequel to Paul Burke, my prediction, right?
I think everyone has their own
different ways. I'm saying, I'm like, God damn it, that guy's fucking funny and lucid and articulate and can stop talking, actually. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think that like your audience is obviously advertising folks and people who are interested in advertising and you know, I don't know. You know, I don't think I have a philosophy or a thing I'm dying to get off my chest. But, you know, I just wish that advertising people would stop imagining that they're in the technology business because they so aren't. You know, that'd be my big thing. You're terrible at being a technology, you know, other than Apple.
Of course.
You know? Yeah. You know what I mean? But I think that's been the biggest plague of our industry. And the biggest thing is like, you know, like advertising has gone all, you know, BuzzFeed sort of, you know, 5 hot ways you can integrate your product into Snapchat and all that sort of stuff. It's like we're in a communications industry. We need to connect with people. And if the mediums that are being offered to us don't do that, they're not good mediums, you know. And Apple, you know, my favorite thing about Apple is you work on Apple.
Yeah.
Their media plan.
Yeah.
And their social media policy, there is none, you know.
Yes, I wish I could go into that further. Unfortunately, I'm bound to an IMERTA and many non-disclosure agreements where I can't talk about that at all.
But I always think that like everybody holds up Apple, nobody does their media plan. That'd be and I started in media, you know, so it's full circle right there.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
I think I'm allowed to say that we do have media in house, and I think that that's a very unusual thing these days, and people don't integrate media with creativity in the way that they used to. I mean, back in the 80s and maybe a bit into the 90s, media was in the ad agency. And once that separation happened, you lost a huge amount of the power. But it was, instead of 2 + 2 = 5, it was 2 + 1.5 + a bit, and then this.
Yeah.
And
that's one thing we have the escape on is that synergy, because, I mean, I started in media. You know, I know how powerful it is when you're in the center break of Coronation Street on a Wednesday night. Boom!
Well, yeah, it's also about, you know, you want your work to be famous and known and stuff. And I was just speaking to Mary Weir, who wrote Make Poverty History, and the fact that...
Oh, Mary Weir!
Yeah, she I spoke to her yesterday.
I know her.
She's great, yeah.
I met her, this little aside,
yeah.
Sorry, audience. Her and Damon Collins,
yes,
were partners, right, at GGT. And I remember I phoned them up and I said, please look at my work. And her and Damon Collins spent a good hour talking to me out of the goodness of their heart. And they'd done that famous Starometer thing for the, you know, for the Tube.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you guys are awesome. And it was like Wayne's World, you know. I was like, God, your guys are so good and not worthy, you know.
Well, you'll find some interesting stories in my chat with her. But
sorry, I got off topic. But
well, she didn't mention ever giving a crit to Vinnie Warren. And maybe, I wonder if she remembers. It'd be quite interesting.
Probably not. I don't know.
Yeah, you never had a name. But anyway, she was saying that she wrote Make Poverty History, and then, you know, wherever it was a month later, Nelson Mandela is saying it in Trafalgar, yes, Square, and it's all over the stage with Pink Floyd reforming and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, my God.
And it's that level of fame that I think, and it may have been what Paul Burke mentioned as well, that when you have a big campaign that maybe worked on Snapchat or was big on, I don't know, some other social media, the taxi driver who takes you for a journey probably won't have seen that, or it won't be as famous in the same way. Whereas if you do a What's Up or The Man Your Man Can Smell Like or Happy Cigar Called Hamlet, people know that. And I think that kind of gratification and that validation of what you do in terms of its fame, to me, that's what we should be working towards. It should always be, you know, that there's a classic thing that at Crispin Porter, one of the things they ask is, what's the press release for this piece of work? And if you're not doing something that's going to be huge and famous, then, you know, where your ambition really isn't enough, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that basically what it comes down to is like what people forget about advertising is that it's advertising. It's a competitive advantage. That's the whole goal, right? Of advertising is to gain a competitive advantage. And people got too fixated upon the medium and the delivery method of that versus thinking about it holistically. And I'm sorry, but you know, for all the technological advantages that have happened in the last 20 plus years, nobody's come up with a better storytelling medium than video. You know, they just haven't. People still walk into a darkened room like they did in the 1920s and pay money to sit down in front of a sparkling screen. And that's the key, I think. You know, it's like, if you want to tell a story, tell a story. Come up with an interesting story. You know, come up with a hook, whatever. But we have to reach lots of people. You're in America, 300 million people.
Yeah.
You know? Right? So there you go. How do you do that when your message is a can of peas, is 10 cents lower than it was last week? And that's mostly marketing, you know? It just is. Not everything's got iPhone 7, you know? Or the Samsung 7.
Or the Samsung 7.
We've now banned on planes.
Explosive. The Samsung 7. Yeah.
Disaster of the century.
Yeah, that's very good for us. We like Samsung's disasters in our agency.
Oh my God, I was on the plane yesterday. I was like, if you're holding a Samsung 7,
get off the plane now.
You know, Apple's got to be doing, popping the champagne about that one.
Yeah, I think it's good payback for all the time Samsung ripped off Apple's stuff. And this is karma is a bitch.
Yeah, Richard, we're probably ripping off their non-exploding technology next time.
Exactly. Yeah, well, they did their own innovation to have an exploding phone. We never did that, and I think that was a good reason.
You know what? What's the Apple version of the exploding phone? That's what I want to know.
We'll explode more tastefully. We'll
or, you know, 3D, you know, exactly. Projection.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much for making the time to have a chat. I think...
Thank you, man, for asking me. I'm in good company. Just don't make me follow Paul Burke, because that's too much. Maybe squeeze in a Mary Weir.
Well, Mary Weir will, I mean, if it's all, I just keep them chronological because, you know, why not? But I spoke to Emma Stamp, who basically started off all the John Lewis ads and that entire genre of advertising. And then I spoke to Mary, and now I'm speaking to you. And I'm hoping to do someone like Paul Belford in the coming week. And maybe I'll get to Lee Clow, because he's my ultimate boss. I don't see why.
I met Lee Clow. You know, around about the time of What's Up, I used to. I knew I had some clout, so I figured I'll get interviews with everybody. You know, I want to meet Lee Clow. You know, and I met Lee Clow, and he was like, I was listening to a podcast on, what was it about, Lauren Michaels, the head of SNL.
Yeah.
It was Mark Moran. It's a good one.
It's really it's really good. It's really good.
And I'm listening to that. And like, I think he's the Lauren Michaels of advertising.
He is. It's amazing how it's amazing to see him work, for one thing, and to see how he runs and, you know, makes the agency take over by being a sort of amazing god of advertising that we all look up to and have huge respect for.
Yeah, I remember when I met him, and I was expecting an interview, and I was kind of just milking, and I was kind of wasting his time, to be honest with you. It's just to meet him, you know, just because I'm that guy. I'll go out of my way to meet somebody, you know. I met Dave Abbott, I met Tony Brignall, you know, and Bob Levinson and Kurt Cobain. I was going to say Kurt, wasn't him? Kurt, the VW?
Not Kurt Cobain.
German guy, right? So I'm like, all right, you're up next, Lee Cloud. You're going to surf it through me. And I brought out a bunch of fucking tapes or something, you know. And he turns to me and he goes, like Martin Michaels, he goes, Vinny, you know, we're media artists. And I'm like, that's never going to make it as a name. Right? He says to me, we're media artists. And he goes, and you know what else? It's going east to west. I'm like, what does that mean? And he goes, well, you know, look at the trend. White and Kennedy's in Portland. We're in the West Coast. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, you're so fucking right. I got to move out here. But like, he was so like, what's the word, clipped? For an American, he was very like, you know, for like Lorne Michaels, he was very like, you know, clipped and phrases. He probably said a million times to a million people, you know, I'm just the latest one. But I was like, he made a huge impression on me. I'm like, yeah, you're dead right and all those things. We are media artists and it is going with, you know. So there
absolutely.
You go.
Absolutely. Cool. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
I hope the audio comes out. And if it doesn't come out, I'll just have it reworked and remastered by Bob Ezrin.
That sounds good. Cool. Well, have a good rest of your Sunday, and I'll send this to you when it's done.
Cheers, man. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Apologies to all the UK. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sure that they're all delighted with everything they just said.
Okay. Cheers, man. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Vinny.
To watch Christmas.